All right, I'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. And first one to welcome the guests that we have with us. So if everyone wants to introduce themselves, Ted is a guest.
I'm Clayton, I'm a US Bank intern, so kind of here with Brad.
Okay.
I'm Alex, I go to University of Kansas, also an intern.
I'm Dan Dannenberg, an observer fellow at the League of Women Voters.
I'm Shannon Howery, I'm the executive director of the Lawrence Douglas County Housing Authority.
Great, all right, cut them all, right. Okay, so first item is to approve the minutes from May 10th, 2019 meeting.
Can I have every mention of Eastman changed to East House throughout the minutes?
I'm sorry about that. Yes.
I mean, I don't know if it's Eastman now.
It's right up at the top.
Yeah, it's right there, but every other, Eastman.
Oh dear.
This Ken Eastman guy, man, he really knows what he's talking about.
Yes, I will change that.
Any other changes? All right, does anyone want to make a motion to accept the minutes with the one change?
So moved.
Second.
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, so next item is to review and provide recommendation to the city commission, county commission, and the school board on the revisions to 826 Street NRA plan. Do I need to read all of that?
No. I am gonna kind of go over both items together though.
Okay, awesome.
Because both are closely related, and if you've looked at the materials, you can see how they align.
Okay,
quite
great.
A bit. So,
Before you, I'm sorry, go ahead, Patrick.
Before you jump in, I know we're close to having a quorum, so this is, right?
We have a quorum.
We have a quorum,
yes.
So for voting, for me, then I brought this up last time, and I'm interested in hearing the group's input on this, because I vote on this as a county commissioner, making a recommendation to myself on a board of three is interesting to me. And I'm just interested in getting some feedback from the group on that, but I also know that we've got to have enough votes as well.
Yeah. Well, traditionally, I've sat here as vice mayor, and as mayor, recommending to myself back when we had those. And I mean, it is a little bit different because the scope that you consider as a commissioner is different than the scope that we're considering in here. But I don't see.
What's the vote in Congress where they don't really vote? They top out and don't vote. I mean, could that?
Yeah, you just vote present.
I mean, is that, or do we need Patrick to say yay or nay on something? Or
well,
today?
So if Patrick has that problem, then I would have that same problem being the school board representative. My belief on this is that it wouldn't even be problematic for the city commission to have a voting city commissioner here and voting on making a recommendation to the city commission. This is a committee of that body, and you're making a recommendation. This recommendation goes to the school board, it goes to the county commission. I don't see it as any different than having a board committee that looks at something and makes a recommendation to the board in terms of they've looked at it in detail. Here's what our recommendation is. And so I disagree with the city's decision to take city commissioners off of this body for that reason. I think that as a body that's made up of multiple government agencies, they ought to have a voting city commissioner sitting on this committee. But I don't think that as long as it's not something like the Peasley thing that was last time where there's kind of that conflict of interest because you're employed by the school board, the school district. I don't see it as problematic.
Okay.
I agree with you.
Okay.
That's my stance.
Madam Chairman, I do have a conflict on this matter, and I'll have to recuse myself.
Okay.
Can
I would be interested if anybody disagrees with me. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
No, I tend to agree with you, Shannon, that because this is kind of a joint council, that the city should have a member here. I was a little bit, I don't know, taken aback when that particular change went through, but that was their decision at that point in time. But I personally, I would say I don't have any problem with either of you voting on these sorts of things. And I think it might be a little bit different for you, Patrick, because it's a three-member board versus a much larger board in the school board's case. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't single-handedly override the other two if they have a different opinion. So
I think at the time the former county commissioner served on PERC, I believe he voted. I don't think he ever recused himself.
Mike, yeah.
Mike did.
Yeah.
And even when Leslie was on, she voted.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was for something that, you know, then went on and she voted again for that.
I think it was this particular governing body who decided they weren't going to be involved in any advisory boards.
It's which, you know, if my personal feeling is that without also having the county commission and the school board also do the same thing, it was absolutely absurd.
Mm-hmm.
So
thank you.
I can see the real overlap when it's city, county, school district. It makes sense for us all to sort of sit and understand the other perspectives of the other boards. So I appreciate your guidance on that. Right. I just wanted to think that through and think about it out loud, really.
And I know Shannon has many times advised, in this case it would be Dr. Anthony Lewis, in terms of how to handle them receiving, the school board receiving an item that's coming down to them after she's been to PERC, because she's understood the nitty gritty of it, whereas most of the time the school board and a lot of the other commissions, they want to hear the big picture, not necessarily all the details.
Okay,
so
thanks.
Okay. And then I just wanted to double check, Greg, are you only recusing yourself from the 826 item?
Yes.
Okay, because I think we'll need to the vote separately on each of these items, but I kind of want to explain them in tandem since they are so closely related. So if you are ready.
And I think, Brad, given your conflict, I would suggest that since you recuse yourself, if you would leave the discussion,
okay.
And then I can come and grab you as soon as this item is over, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that's how you handle it, sure.
Okay.
Except that if she's
going to
explain things together, then he's going to.
Yeah, you may not want to.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell.
Yeah.
I've
okay.
kind
fine.
Of
that's fine.
Briefed you guys all on this. okay, I want to, these two items, as I already mentioned, they're closely related. They have to do with shoring up affordable housing compliance reporting requirements. So to a large extent, it's more of an administrative cleanup. And I want to give you guys a little bit of background in case you weren't here back when 826 Pennsylvania Street NRA plan was approved. That was approved before we had a change in our economic development policy that required affordable housing. And it was before AHAB had even, they had just started to get their footing. They had not even defined affordable housing. So we went in, the governing body elected to require affordable housing out of this project. But we had no policy that was guiding us. So we knew that at some point down the road, we were going to have to come back and address this when we all understood a little bit more. So with the 826 project, they sent in their first compliance application. And of course, we had a little scenario that we had not contemplated. And this was where one of the affordable housing tenants had met compliance for 10 out of the 12 months, except he got a job. And then his income went over the threshold. And so then that brought up a whole discussion about, well, what is the intent of requiring affordable housing? Do we really want to force these people out? Because the intent of most of these programs is for them to increase their lot in life and improve their situation. So city staff consulted with Shannon at the Lawrence Douglas County Housing Authority, because she handles all sorts of affordable housing programs. And we also consulted with Tom Jackson of NDC, because they're very involved with community development and affordable housing. So we we spent quite a bit of time talking with them and trying to get some guidance, looking at the other types of affordable housing programs and what they require, and trying to morph them into something that would meet, that would be appropriate for not only revising the 826 PIN NRA, but also revising our economic development policy to kind of follow suit. So basically, if you've looked at any of these, just to give you an overview of the NRA plan revisions, we added clarification on tenant eligibility and certification requirements. We addressed a potential proration of rebate and reimbursement based on a minimum time requirement that the unit is to be occupied by an eligible tenant. So that, I think that was on advice of Shannon, so that we just let them know that they've got to fill this unit with an affordable housing tenant. And then we tweaked the form, the compliance reporting form, to kind of match, and then updated throughout the plan references to that form. So that was 826. The economic development policy, we did add a rounding clause in for cases where the affordable housing set aside percentage calculation returns a fraction of a unit. That was something that PERC had talked about when it came time to update. Again, we added clarification on tenant eligibility and certification requirements, added a clause on potential proration of the rebate based on, you know, the minimum that they have to have an eligible tenant in there. And then we also require the landlord to work with the Lawrence Douglas County Housing Authority for tenant income verification and eligibility. And the reason that is so is because they have all the software. It's very inexpensive. The alternative is that the developer slash landlord has to collect all this financial data, keep those records, and make sure that they are following all the ins and outs required by, you know, whatever to make compliance. So this is a much easier, quick, simple, inexpensive solution. They are serving as a third party. They will submit to us a certification as well as to the landlord. We will know that everything is taken care of at that point. So the city doesn't have to keep those records. Landlord doesn't have to keep those records. So we think it'll be a more efficient process. And then also, I thought it was necessary, if a project is already certified under a federal affordable housing program, such as low-income housing tax credits, we don't want to get into that. If they're eligible for that program and they stay eligible, then I think that meets whatever. We don't need to delve into that at all. So that was the other provision.
Am I allowed to ask, does the landlord have issue with this change? Has he expressed any
issue? No, he seems very on board with this. For this particular rebate, we figured out a proration amount with the caveat that if all of these changes get approved, then he'd get the remainder of that rebate.
Thank you.
So we think it's going to be an easier, more efficient process for everybody. And we're probably going to have a lot more accurate in terms of certification and eligibility and all that as well. So that gives you a little bit of context. And so that's my... All right, if you guys have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
So I just want to make sure I heard clearly. So for the income requirements, the city won't be keeping the records of the income eligibility for the tenants, and now the landlord won't be. Is anyone going to be keeping those records in the event of needing an audit of some sort in the future?
All the requirements, all the documentation will be handled by the Lawrence Douglas County Housing Authority.
And I can give you our retention schedules, right? But we're a component unit. Our audit's in your audit, in the city's audit. And we keep tenant records. We're also subject to the Privacy Act. So one of the other things we kind of bring to the table is, you know, all of our files are locked every single night. Nobody's income information and social security numbers and all those go anywhere. We have access to a federal system called EIV. It's an income verification software that the federal government uses 100% of our programs. We have to determine income eligibility on. So this is something we do all day, every day.
And their proposal is in part of the packet, and it just kind of tells you all the things that they would be checking and going through with their program.
And they would provide us just the general documentation that, yes, this person does meet.
Right.
So all we wanted to know was, had they gone through the housing authority's process, and is it good, and then it satisfies what our requirement would be as proposed.
So two questions looking at the application. Who pays the service fee? Is that the
landlord would pay the fee.
Okay. And then how often is the your tenants or these tenants re-verified? So like if a person is in there for a year and then decides to stay for a year, is it re-verified at the end of that year?
Yeah, so the way it's scheduled is right. Once a year in December as you get to the determination of whether they've met your requirements, we'll recertify. Now, if someone moves out in the middle of the year and they're moving someone in and they want us to do something before somebody gets in, that's also fine, we'll do that.
Mm-hmm. But it would not, like the tenant you mentioned, Brett, that where the income changed mid-year, it would not address those kind of, that's...
No, all of that is part of the new schedule that we're outlining here. So basically, they're going to have to get certified before they sign a lease. Mm-hmm. And then once a year, they would go through additional certification, I believe, at the end of December, because that's when all of the certifications, both for the Lawrence Douglas County Housing Authority as well as the city, we need that to happen in December so that in January we can make sure that we give reimbursements. So just timing wise, and then also our schedule does allow some flexibility so that if somebody does get a job, that they aren't instantly kicked out because they're over the threshold. So we change that to align it with more of the regular affordable housing programs where we are actually, we're not penalizing somebody for making their life better, because that's the intent of the affordable housing programs.
It's not just an annual check. So if I'm in the program, I have leased a unit and my income qualified me and I got a job, wouldn't it just be an annual? So I'd be under no obligation to report a change in income necessarily, except the year is up. And now because of that, someone else mm-hmm. who is more, you know, in need.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which is perfect.
Another question on this. If a tenant goes over income at the end of the year and the landlord elects not to select another unit to be the low income unit, how long does the current tenant have before
the
landlord can evict?
That is also in our schedule here, because they have to, the landlord has to give notice to the tenant that their income is now over the limit, but it's at 100% of, for the 826 is MFI, medium family income. Our policy is AMI, which is
area
median. Okay, so that's part of the thing that we're dealing with a couple of different. But yeah, they give them notice, and then I think they have a year.
Okay, that's what I thought I'd seen in there. I wanted to make mm-hmm. sure about that. What's the expectation of how landlords will respond to this? That more often they would select another unit, or are the low-income units substantively different than other units?
Well,
are unlikely to do that.
We only have one project now.
Okay.
It's the 826 where this is the case. And they have just dedicated two units. So they don't have like floating units.
Okay.
We do have a provision here where they you know, they can't just be the rundown units. They have to meet a certain standard based on the rest of the units and that sort of thing. For the 826, it's a one bedroom. So they provide 2 1 bedroom.
I was, you know, I was mostly interested in thinking through the scenario and the impact on somebody that is trying to better their life and has raised their income. And I guess, I guess what I see is they have a year at least to find
it. Yeah, they would have, and that's once they reach 100% of the threshold. They will have at least a year's notice that, you know, they'll have to either, you know, relocate or it goes to market rate rent and then another unit is provided for.
And that threshold is adjusted every year for inflation, et cetera.
HUD puts out income eligibility for all the different programs once a year. So.
And so we were just really trying to mirror what how Shannon and her agency handles this, because we thought you all have a very extensive track record with dealing with this kind of thing and handling it in a fair manner. That was
so if somebody has a housing voucher, it works pretty much the same way.
Yeah.
Every, 1 year.
Every program we run, has a, so you reach, so a housing voucher, once you reach 100%, for us it's area median income, well then our part of the rent payment is zero. So you have 6 months of zero, of us paying zero, that the voucher is still there in case you need it. And then after that point, they roll off and we reissue that voucher to another.
I gotcha, thank you. Do most cities handle this situation in a similar way? Is this best practice? Is kind of what I'm trying to get at. I can't think of a better solution, but I'll ask the question.
I would imagine. There are not very many cities, though, that I think that attach affordable housing to the incentives in the way that we do in the first place, so we're kind of a leader in that area. But I would imagine that they try to align however they're administering it as closely with something that has been administered for a long time, and that was kind of our go-to with this concept.
Okay, thank you.
Once we encountered, we see that having a very hard and fast rule that the person can only be under this may not be a very fair situation.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. I had a question for Diane. I had a question about the provision in the policy designated the agency. So it just says to work with a local not-for-profit. To work with local not-for-profit agencies, why didn't it specify the housing authority that's who we were working with?
Are you looking at the current policy or the markups? I think we addressed that.
Oh, maybe I'm looking at the wrong part of it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. In section 1.8.3.5, on page 13 of the marked up version.
Okay. All right. So I was that's maybe why I was confused. All right. I was looking at the wrong person.
Never mind.
The reason why it was in there originally was there are several other agencies that do this kind of thing to verify income originally, but I think because of the fact that the Housing Authority is a governmental entity, they are closely connected with the city, as Shannon was saying, that's where we thought we should have a clear process with one is what we to be consistent.
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. I was looking at the wrong.
A lot of papers.
Well, and I just was, I had read through it and person it out, and I was like, that's all right.
Okay.
So, okay. 826 is our only property right now in the city that is using the NRA in this way, correct?
That has affordable housing provision. There is the Vermont Place project was an NRA for the proposed kind of mixed use project. Yeah, Mr. Shem's project, and but that doesn't seem to be proceeding. But it did have some affordable housing provisions in it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the City Commission knew that these two were kind of the guinea pigs.
for doing.
Has there been much interest from developers or anyone else that's approached the city? I mean, we're, you know, there's a lot of language that we're dumping into, or a lot of effort towards these policies, but you know, we haven't really gotten a whole lot of traction on these policies for the past year and a half or so.
I think what it does is it enables us to have that conversation when we have a developer that's interested in seeking assistance with a mixed use project. And so that situation on those mixed use ones are ones that don't come up all that frequently. But had we had such a provision in the past, for example, some of the programs, some of the projects on New Hampshire would have had to comply with this, but we didn't have this kind of a requirement in place. It does, and this was discussed at the time when that provision was added, it does have the effect of increasing the developer's gap, because there is a cost to providing these affordable units. It is either a significant upfront cost in the case of a sale of a unit that's going to be permanently affordable, or an ongoing subsidy, you know, and a cost in that way that the project has to absorb. And so so those things are all kind of contemplated. But we just don't have these kind of mixed-use projects that have this number of housing units that trigger this come up very frequently, I guess.
So, question, I mean, first of all, great that the Housing Authority is willing to do this for what seems to be an incredibly reasonable fee of $25 an hour. That's just awesome. And we don't have a high demand as well, so I don't expect, but I'm interested in, you said there were other agencies, but there probably isn't another agency in town that can do the level of what you detail here. But they just don't have the capacity, right?
Okay. Doubtful. I mean, Tenants to Homeowners is the only other one that I'm aware of who does some income verification, but they run a tax credit. I think, you know, Britt alluded to it, so we talk about median family income here and area median income, and you'll see in our proposal we say we will calculate income according to the home regulation, because each one of these programs has its own slightly different rules, right? And so something's going to come up in here. Does it count as income or not? Like, good example that we run into is tribal income. There's many different categories of tribal income, and how that counts or doesn't count, we will use the home regs to make that determination so there is some even standard. We're the only group in town who would administer home regs.
And I think it's important to note that this doesn't preclude a developer with working with Tenants to Homeowners if that particular model where they have more of an ownership model, and they have a land trust in their projects that they leverage some kind of a land ownership provision to ensure the affordability over time. And for units that are being sold, which is the case with Mr. Shum's project, it made perfect sense for them to work with Tenants to Homeowners. That could still happen, and probably would be suggested if ownership is involved. But then it gives us a consistent way of doing income verification for the life of the project through using the Housing Authority, I think. And then that way everybody's on the same page. We have the same form. We ask Shannon's organization to do it every year for all of the applicable units, and kind of have a standard go-to there.
So as far as PERC's responsibility, then, you know, we're in the weeds a little bit about the affordable housing aspect, but that's not necessarily the purview of this committee. All we would necessarily be concerned with is, are the properties meeting compliance? And you'd be the one saying, okay, yep, they are, and okay, we approve it every year. So it's, from my understanding, it's just adjusting the text amendments to everything to comply with kind of a wonky situation we had. And as far as PERC and the incentives are, as long as they're meeting and okay, next.
And we did take this to the Affordable Housing Advisory Board mm-hmm. for their thoughts, since they are looking more in, that's a board yeah. looking particularly at that angle, and they recommended approval.
This is cleaning up the language administratively and letting the experts handle the verification of income and storing that material, so that makes all the sense in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. Any other questions from the board members?
Any questions from the board? My sense of mind can't get around any of this. It seems like there, as is government's want, there are, we've got tenants to homeowners, we've got the Lawrence Douglas County Housing Authority, we've got something else over here. We have Homeless Coalition. It just seems to me, and there's no, to the best of my knowledge, there's no registry of rental properties in the city where there's a record. And now we have short-term rentals, which I call the party house provision. And then we have Airbnb, and then we have something else. On my street, I have no idea. When I first moved in on my street, it was all owned by individual occupiers. Now it's all rental properties. And I think there's one property owned, there is a short-term rental, but I don't know. And I think the city needs to, and the county too, needs to get something together so we know what's going on. Rental properties are going to become more and more important, I think. I don't know. Because people just can't, a lot of people just can't afford to buy a house.
Short-term rentals are these Airbnb type system are incredibly important when you're talking about affordable housing in a community. There, I know of houses that were rentals that are now 100% short-term rentals. There's not much that's so. This helps on one level. You really, with a comprehensive discussion of affordable housing, you could not have that discussion without talking about short-term rentals.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that discussion is ongoing with the commission currently.
Yeah.
And and we do have a regular rental, or just a rental licensing program in place currently that does require people that are renting to register. Yeah, and short-term renters are also supposed to be doing that as well. But that discussion, that process is still a little bit under discussion. There's some rules now, but they're talking about possibly changes to those.
Is there a publicly available database of landlords who received a license?
Yes, and we even have a map.
That can solve some of your problems.
Well, I'm pathetic at the computer, and I've seen the map. All I see is a bunch of little dots around the city. Is there some place that tells you this address is owned by such and such? This address is owned by such and
I'll,
such?
I'll help you with it afterwards. Okay. I'll show you.
Yeah, I would really like to see that, because I think that's very important.
So Diane will help you out with that. All right, any other questions? All right, so do we go ahead and vote before Brad comes back?
I would hold a vote on the 826
one.
Okay, and then we can bring Brad in and then hold a vote on the policy one.
I move to approve item 2, review and provide. I vote to approve the changes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, motion passes. All right, and then we'll move move on to item three on the agenda. Does anyone have any motion for that?
Move to approve.
Second.
Anyone in favor? Everyone in favor, sorry. Anyone in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, motion passes. All right, and then item four is just public comment for anything on the agenda. Does anybody have anything?
Well, I would just mention a couple other things. I was watching one of the channels in Kansas City a while back, and they were interviewing a woman who was renting an apartment, and she said that she and the landlord had agreed that the landlord would charge her 30% of her monthly income as rent. She said that was really working out well for her. I think she was a single parent. And I don't know whether similar things happen here in Louisville or not. And they also mentioned, you know, this is one of these little secrets that never gets discussed, that in Kansas City, at least half of the evictions are due to behavioral issues, like doing narcotics or something. Not so much failing to pay rent. And I don't know how that sorts out here in Lawrence. The number of, they call them displacements in the housing market analysis. You know, we have to kind of parse our terms, I guess. Nobody gets evicted, they get displaced. So I don't know how that works out here. Is there a record of displacements over a period of time, and how those come about, whether it's for not paying rent or other things?
You don't do that through the rental registry, do you?
No, I'm not aware of that data being collected, unless our resource, Shannon, might.
Okay, so if there is an official legal eviction, it will have a limited action number in the court system. There's an expedited docket for that. The vast majority of those situations are non-payment of rent.
Excuse me, are those handled through state district court or through municipal court?
State district court. And so I don't know if the clerk can run how many evictions happened in the last year. I've never asked for that data, but I do know they're all public record over there.
But it probably would not separate it out for
why?
Reason, right? It would just be an eviction.
It would not. And here's why most of them are for non-payment of rent. If you have a lease violation and you're pursuing a lease violation, you have to give what's called a 1430. So you give a notice that the person has 14 days to correct the lease violation, or in 30 you will take eviction action. If the tenant corrects, they get to stay. It's a very different process. If they don't pay rent and you give them notice 3 days after you give notice, you can file an eviction. It's on an expedited docket, so we all file by Wednesday. We get on the docket by the next, not 2 days later, but a week later, we get on a docket and it moves that quickly. So the vast majority of them are non-payment of rent because it's an expedited docket and for that. And the other question you asked is everyone, 100% of the individuals who participate with the housing authority pay no more than 30% of their income in rent.
And that's just so you know, like even lenders, when we're underwriting loans, our general rule of thumb is we like to have their housing expense be below 28%. But if I'm, but 28% is kind of the norm for lending for housing. And then if I'm sitting down with someone who does rent and they're having problems making their payments, I will calculate and I go up to 30 for something like that. And so 30 is kind of the norm of rent. No more than 30% of their income.
Well, the other, while I'm mouthing off here, the other thing that I have a concern about is vacant properties I can go two blocks down here and see probably three properties that have been vacant for not decades, but years. And one of the properties is probably used for storage because there's all sorts of furniture piled in. But I don't know, is it uninhabitable for people? The other property has been worked on, but it's still, you know, it's just worked on. And I think I know who the landlord is, and I think he's one of the local favorites. I think he's just quite blunt about it. And so I think there needs to be some tracking on vacant properties, how long they've been vacant, what their situation is. Why aren't they on the market? So I'll shut up.
All right. Any other comments? All right. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All right. Meeting adjourned. Everyone have a good evening.
Thank you all.